All right. What?
Good evening to everyone. We were starting to record, so I'm just gonna jump right in. I have one copy here that does not have a staple. If you could be responsible with that, that'd be great. Otherwise, these all have staples.
Welcome to our second session of the Mary Heitkin Dumont University. And this is all in loving memory of Mary Heitkin Dumont, who is a friend of many here, and including myself, and neighbor, and a longtime participant and contributor to our congregation many years, and we remember her memory this evening. We'll begin our task in a second, but first let's just go around and say greetings for a moment. I'm Rabbi Joel Finkelstein.
I'm Michael DeLucas.
Michael
Weaver. Todd Grover. Noel Copper. Mary Mastine. Lisa. All right. Good to have everybody here. Our first session was a very popular topic of Jesus as false Messiah. Of course, for Jews, Jesus was a false Messiah. We did mention that the Rambam said that he did pave the way for the Messiah in the sense that Christianity opens people a little bit more to some of the truths of Judaism, but more or less, for Jews, Jesus is a false Messiah. And this week we're talking about Bar Kokhba as a false Messiah within the Jewish community. Next week we'll talk about Shabtai Tzvi, a very fascinating story in more modern times. Bar Kokhba and Jesus as messianic figures couldn't be more different. They're only about 100 years apart, but they couldn't be more different. Firstly, in terms of historical record, and secondly, in terms of exactly what we talked about last week, and the two ideas are related. Let me explain. We said last week that Jesus didn't achieve on the ground a lot of all the main things that we're looking for. We're looking for the ingathering of the exiles. We're looking for the creation of a Jewish state. We're looking for the sanctification of God's name through the people of Israel. We're looking for the rebuilding of the temple. We're looking for, what else, the rising of the pride of the Jewish people such that the world would recognize that God is true and the Torah is true and Sinai is true. And instead, we have someone who claims more of a spiritual kind of a redemption, which doesn't seem to jive with many of the prophecies that speak about redemption. This week, we have almost the opposite. Almost the opposite. We have a man of very strong accomplishments on the ground. We'll see in a moment. And for a Jewish state. And we'll see whether he's a little bit short or very short on the spiritual side. So we have two very different characters. Because one dealt in the concrete, namely Bar Kokhba, and one dealt with words, Jesus, therefore the record is much stronger for whom? No. The record, the physical record is better for Bar Kokhba because we're going to have coins, we're going to have letters, we're going to have historians talking about him. Whereas for Jesus, he's a man, a preacher, he said some speeches, there's very little, what did he achieve physically? So there isn't as much material culture. Jews in general don't have much material culture like idolaters and other people. So, interesting contrast. Now, we, along those lines, evening, come on in. Along those lines, we begin with how concrete his kingdom was, how much he was on the way toward a Jewish kingdom. Bar Kokhba, we're talking about a man who lived around the year 130. We're talking that the temple was destroyed in the year 70. We're talking about a person living under Roman rule. We're talking about the times of Rabbi Akiva, the days of the Mishnah, and there's a fellow named really Bar Koziva or Kozva, and we're talking about his accomplishments. So, firstly, we have evidence in a Tosefta, in Ma'aseh Sheni, it talks about the Bar Kokhba coins. We have them right here. You can see them, right? The first one is all about what? Is all about what? What does it show? What aspiration does it show? The temple, the idea of Jerusalem. Yeah, I don't have all the details. But apparently there was some success in Jerusalem, And there may have even, he may have even brought some sacrifice, may have set up some sort of a nascent temple, but clearly he felt that there was some freedom for Jerusalem. So there you have that. In the second coin, what's the main theme? What does it simply assert? Very important. The what?
Freedom.
Freedom, right? And what else? A very important historical fact, which is what? Spoken like a true trumpeter. On the trumpets, yes. On the one with the trumpets. Right, this could be a trumpet. It could also be a cornucopia. Okay. What else? Maybe. Good, good, good.
Music.
What else? Year 2 to the freedom of Israel. I don't read ancient Hebrew. But year 2, the different alphabet than what we use, year 2 to the freedom of Israel. The Talmud is going to assert it in a couple of minutes. We're going to see. The Talmud asserts that 2.5 years he reigned. Here's an actual coin that says, from year 2 of Bar Kokhba. It's a physical thing. He's reigning. He's got coins, right? Right. Two-bit mayors don't have coins. This is a fellow who's got a little fiefdom going. He's got coins. There's plenty of them out there. It's not like there's a rare coin. There are Bar Kokhba coins. And look at the Mishnah, the Tosefta. Now, we know Mishnah is the basis of the Talmud. Tosefta is something similar to the Mishnah, written either right after the Talmud or in the days of the Mishnah, depending on the particular passage. And it's various laws. Who would like to read that law for us? It alludes to Bar Kokhba. Who would like to read that for us? Micah, you want to try that? You cannot.
You cannot transfer the holiness on a Mador, Aurora coin, and not on a coin that is not in currency.
So if you want to take you have a lot of fruit, and you want to bring it to Jerusalem to eat 1/10 of your produce in Jerusalem, as you're supposed to do during certain years, but you can't bring that much fruit, there's too much. The Torah says, put it on a coin. Redeem all your many grapes on this sack of coins, and then you take the coins to Jerusalem, buy food, and you can eat in Jerusalem with your family and with the poor people. Now, but if those coins are coins that are not in currency, you can't do it. What's the example of not in currency? Go ahead.
And not on coins, not in your possession. How so? He had Kasbiot, Kosbiot coins.
Right, you could read it, if you look in the Hebrew, in the second line, Kazaviot or Kozaviot. It could be, Bar Kokhba's name either comes from a place, an obscure place mentioned once in the Bible, and he's from there. Later on, it was interpreted to be Kozev, that he was a liar. He was a false Messiah. Anyway, so later, they may have wanted to refer to him as Kozaviot in terms of the liar, or Kazaviot, maybe he was more Kazbi or something like that, Bar Kozaviot. Kazbia. Anyway, the Tosefta, a Jewish legal text, perhaps 100 years after Bar Kokhba, perhaps several hundred years after Bar Kokhba, refers to people who've got the wrong kind of coins. They've got Bar Kokhba coins. So I'm just showing you, it's something that the rabbis are aware of after his death, something that you can look at today, that they're all over the place. This is a leader who left behind a material culture. He was a leader who coined coins. And I'll show you something else. Apparently, he had a sphere of influence over this entire midsection of Israel, mostly in the Judean hills. People don't live on the coastline. Arabs didn't live on the coastline until the Jews came along. And the Jews lived in the hills here, the Judean hills. And places like Yavne and Beit Guvrin, where there's a big excavation today, Hebron, Tekoa, Engedi, Bethlehem, places near the Gush, Beitar. This was part of his fiefdom, so he had a real sphere of influence. He had coinage. This is a serious attempt at a messianic era to revive a Jewish nation, which was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. The nation was destroyed in the year 70. They didn't have much sovereignty for a long time before that anyway. And here is a nascent attempt. Apparently, I don't know all the details, but apparently politically, there were just a few, Romans were a little bit in disarray, and those 2.5 years were just, and there was the right time when the Romans didn't have their act together. Yes?
Many of
Right, so I guess we could
a lot of action that's in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that's the question. That's one of the questions we could examine. Did he simply sort of mess up at some later point? Or that to begin with, his whole enterprise was rotten to the core. So that's a good, great question. Yes? Yes. We'll see. We will see. Right. At this time, a great rabbi is going to say he's Mashiach. I think he referred to himself as Nasi. Nasi, yeah. Which we'll see what that might mean in a minute. Now, so let's read Eicha Rabba. There are two passages. One in Jerusalem Talmud, which you'll see on page 4, with the Hebrew and then the English. And one on here, right here on page 1. Stay on page 1. We're going to read the Eicha Rabba. I think it's a little bit easier to read this. Which one would be earlier? Eicha Rabba is a Midrash. Or the Jerusalem Talmud. So theoretically, the second source is a little earlier. But they're rather similar. I'll point out a couple of differences. We're not going to read the whole the whole of both of them. Let's just take a look at this very first one. We'd like to read that for us. Bottom of the page. Okay, Lisa? This is a Midrash. You're reading a Midrash. Go ahead. Rabbi. The rabbi here means the rabbi, like I call the Rav is very self-aging. The rabbi is who? We'll get to him later. Rabbi Akiva's student, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Judah the prince, he wrote the Mishnah. Okay, so Rabbi Judah, he lived near the Korban only 100 years or so afterwards. Go ahead.
He used to remember a lecture on crying.
And so you go ahead. Okay, so there's, okay, 1 second. Bilam, the wicked Bilam, you know, he cursed the Jews, but by mistake he blessed them. He gave all these blessings like Matov Olech Yaakov, how goodly are your tents. One of the verses he said was, a star has gone forth from Jacob, and a staff from Judah, and it attacked all the various neighbors of Israel. So he, we'll see some interpretations of it later, but for now, what did he interpret it to mean? That a star would come forth from Jacob? Don't read a star. Right. So in other words, a star from Jacob is the Bar Kochba, the name Bar Kochba is an allusion to this verse, that he's not Bar Koziva, he's Bar Kochba, he's the star, he's the Messiah, he's that star that we've all been waiting for. Go ahead. There's a little confusion in that English translation. Rabbi Akiva, Kad Chame, Lahadein Bar Kochba, when he would see that Bar Kochba, that's a mistake. When he saw that Bar Kochba, he would have a Amar, he would say, Hainu Malka Mashiach, this is the King, the Messiah himself. So it's not the Bar Kochba saying it, but Rabbi Akiva, greatest of rabbis. Okay, now, according to this, who made this interpretation that the star is him? Who made it? Rabbi. If you look in the second version, which is probably the first version, there it says that Rabbi Akiva used to interpret that. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, his student, the one who died in Lag BaOmer, said that Rabbi Akiva used to interpret that Bar Kochba is the true fulfillment of this verse, this blessing of the blessing. Okay, go ahead. Rabbi Yochanan. Right. Now, the Abarbanel would say that the reason this other rabbi was so sure, let's start with this. One reason he may have been so sure is because we'll see that maybe his ethical practices were not proper. That unlike Jesus, who was preaching an ethical message and that kind of stuff, here's someone who we're wondering how ethical he is to begin with. So last week we read, the Rambam said, in order to be Mashiach, one of the things you have to do is you have to study Torah, and you have to be kind of a Moses kind of figure. So he may have flunked on that score. Or he may have been saying to him, it's the wrong era. this is not the time. It's a more mystical thing, based on the verses in Daniel that the Rabbi Nell is very big on. Another thing, it's the wrong time. It's right after the temple was destroyed. It's not the right time. Anyway, it's interesting why this rabbi rejected it. But we'll have some evidence later, but we don't know for se. Go ahead.
Rabbi,
Hadrian. Wait a second. Let's see. The voice of Hadrian, he killed in Beitar. Go ahead. What did he kill in Beitar? I'm sorry. You have to go on. What did he? Let's see. Yeah. I'm sorry. It reads like this. I got confused. He killed in Beitar 80,000 people, and then it says that 80,000 trumpeters were attacking Beitar. So he killed 80,000 people. He killed 1,000, 10,000, which would be, no, that's more, right? That's 800,000 people. Right? What's 1,000, 10,000? Micah? Actuary, sorry? 1 million. But 80,000 people came to attack us with their trumpets. Okay, go ahead. Interesting, trumpets. We saw the trumpets where? I don't know. Go ahead. Right, well, let's see. Yeah, the little confusion here. Bar Kokhba, yeah, I'm sorry. I borrowed this, I lifted this translation. It's a little bit plagued. Bar Kokhba had 200,000 men who were with an amputated finger. So part of showing, like a hazing ceremony of Bar Kokhba people, they had chopped off their finger a little bit. Now, so, in other words, you know, real warriors. You find three eras in which Jews became very militant. What's the first era where you find Jewish warriors, people who killed a lot of people, and each one boasts of having done killed a different giant and that kind of thing? When's that era?
Joshua.
Era.
Well,
I would say the era of David, Saul, from Saul to David. The Jews had enough of being wimps in the days of Samson that they couldn't lift a finger. Now. You had not just one, like Deborah had a nice war, fine. But this is a whole warrior culture, right? This guy, he killed 80 people on the snowy day, and this guy killed that giant. They have a whole list at the end of Samuel 2 of things, military accomplishments. This is another era of extreme militarism after a humiliating defeat at the hands of the Romans in the year 70. And then in modern times also, they have a lot of people take great pride in just standing in the army, etc. So, and we're very proud of that. We have some parents of soldiers right here. I'm an uncle of a soldier as well. These are unusual eras. So they, to show their great heroism, amputated finger. Go ahead.
That already.
Right, well, go ahead. What did the sages say? You're not alone. You're not alone. Ah, so they didn't like this, right? The rabbi said, hey, we're in charge here. We're the rabbis. It's not like today where rabbi, you know, if you want to, you go to the rabbi. I mean, the rabbis had some power. And they said, oh, wait a second. This is not acceptable. What did he say?
He asked them how else shall they do it. They answered, let anyone who does not uproot this in the phenomenon of
the
in your
heart. Let him uproot a tree. Now, later we're going to find this uprooting tree thing. See, later, you have various legends of things like that, like Moses came to Jethro's backyard and he said, I got this tree. I got it from, you know, from Garden of Eden, from Jacob, but it's stuck in the ground. I can't get it out. So he pulls it out, and then now that became his staff that Moses used to split the sea and everything else. You have stories like that. So it's I don't know. It probably has a Roman image to it. In terms of the finger, I saw an interesting interpretation. Someone said, we were just learning in the Daf Yomi or someplace. We were learning that, or it was learning in Brachos. There was something about a finger. They said, well, what about a finger? So Rabbi Akiva says, you need a finger to learn. The finger is very important because you learn Tame Torah. The reasons of the Torah you learn. The finger, there's a medieval Haggadah from the 1400s. All the rabbis are going like this. Right? Now, we think they go like this. In Eastern Europe, you go like this when you want to study something, make a point. But anyway, so it's interesting. There may be some allusions. A lot of rabbis try to find various allusions to this militarism and this this disgusting culture and all that, within various statements of Rabbi Akiva in Halacha, in Agada, in Midrash. So there was one of them that he talks about the importance of the finger for learning.
Why would a funeral allow his hand to cut off?
I assume it was a hazing of sorts. If you can't cut off your finger, or you can't let us cut it off, then you know you're a wimp. And we don't need you. We don't need you. Yeah, yeah. Probably just a little bit. Anyway. This is Midrash. Midrash, which is the same sort of equivalent to Haggadah. Haggadah has an expression when you find something inside the Talmud. That's found in the Jerusalem Talmud. You would call it Haggadah. And here it's Midrash. Okay, go on. Yeah. What's each class? Some people who up for the tree, and other people who they cut off the face. They already cut it off. So those people he had. Now he had more warriors. Go ahead. Now, comments. Right. So this does not sound very good. Right now, this is a later editorial. Rabbis living after Bar Kokhba fails, claiming that this is what he said. So we have to take this whole story with a grain of salt. But here's an assertion by later rabbis of, you know, some lack of piety on the part of this Bar Kokhba crowd. Neither help us nor discourage us. Go ahead. So an allusion that there's a verse like that that alludes to people having this impious piety. Okay, go ahead. That was the remark of Rabbi Akiva made. What was the remark of Rabbi Akiva? So, someone. Is that supernatural or is that just very heroic? We're going to talk about it later. Let's keep that in mind. Is that something supernatural or something just simply heroic?
The literature of context, in classical and landscape literature about Jewish or not, they exaggerate the number of people who are
Okay. Also, he's uses Kuzma of exaggeration. That's good. Very good. Yes, Lisa.
Okay, so this
story is written later. Yeah, this is not such a great resource for us. I'm not going to give you a detailed analysis tonight of all the different sources. We have Christian sources. There's a lot of different sources. But we're just going to look at these classic Jewish sources. We just have this statement that people said that Rabbi Akiva said this about him.
But Rabbi Akiva would have known for you.
Again, people try to find in other statements of Rabbi Akiva some hint at the same thing. For instance, who gets to go home from war, from battle? So most rabbis say, you have to have like at least one area or a bride, or at least one plant of the vineyard, like the Torah says. But he says that you have to be very good, you know, you have to be brave. But this simple reading of the text that you have to be brave. The Midrashic reading of the text is that why would someone be afraid? Because they have a lot of sins. But he says, if you're afraid, period, then you have to go on. And you have to be a brave warrior. So if I want to interpret that, but this is based on his militaristic ideology that you have to be brave on the ground, in reality, not just not afraid of your sins, but you have to really be brave. So they try to find other sources in Rabbi Akiva in other places, but we don't have a ton, but this is an extensive passage we do have. Okay, then we have a sad ending to the story. It doesn't get any better. Who would like to read this? Steve, want to read that for us? Bottom four.
For 3.5 years, the emperor
of Israel surrounded. Today there's a settlement of Haredi. Most settlements are settled by modern Orthodox, non-Orthodox. but there's one settlement of Haredim, it's very booming with populations, you can imagine, and it's Beitar, a Beitar elite, upper Beitar, probably somewhere near the ancient Beitar.
Correct.
Beitar and Modi are not too far away. So Rabbi Lezer the Modai is a famous rabbi. You'll find him all over the Midrash and the Talmud. He was in that city. Go ahead.
He wore sackcloth and fasted. He used to pray daily, Lord of the universe, sit not in judgment today.
The Talmud pontifically is claiming that the real salvation of the days of Bar Kokhba was Rabbi Lezer the Modai. He was praying. All right, go ahead. Now the Kutians are various sects, various groups that are against the Jews. It could be other sects. You know, there are many different sects in the Dead Sea Scrolls that we learned about, and we always call them generically Kuthi and the Kutites. They didn't always accept the rabbinic law, and so sometimes they may have been on the other side with the Romans. Go ahead.
Much of the emperor found him and said, "My lord, so long as that old cock wallows in ashes, you will not conquer the city."
But there's the spiritual power they have. You got to get rid of that old rabbi. But wait for me.
Because I will do something that will enable you to
do it. So at first, in the other version, Hadrian said, "I'll bring them to me." He says, "No, I can take care of it. I'll do it." Go ahead.
You mean when he entered the day at the city, when he found Rabbi Eliezer standing and crying, particularly the whisper into the
so here's a Kutai on the Roman side going into a militaristic, you know, in today's term, you're like a settler place, you know, a bunch of hard-nosed guys who want to fight the Romans. And here's a guy who's on the Roman side whispering and talking, cohorting with the rabbi. So a little suspicious. Why is the rabbi talking to this peacenik, this fellow on the Roman side? Go ahead. People
went and informed our Kutiba, your friend Rabbi Eliezer wishes to surrender the city to
him. He's hanging out with the enemy. Go ahead.
He sent something the Kutian brought to him and asked, "What did you say to him?" He replied, "I tell you, the emperor will kill me. If I do not tell you, you will kill me."
So I don't know what to say. Go ahead.
It's better that I should kill myself.
This fairy fellow is very clever. He doesn't say what he said to the rabbi. He doesn't want to say anything about it. So he's just like, "Oh, I can't tell you. It's very top secret." Go ahead.
Rabbi Eliezer was convinced that Rabbi Eliezer wanted to surrender the city. So when the latter finished his praying, he had him brought into his presence and asked him, "What did the
Kutian do?" Now, notice he let him finish his prayer. Right? He's not a total brute. He let the rabbi finish his prayer first. Go ahead.
It depends what he does. He answered, "I've not known what he whispered in my ear, nor did I hear anything, because I was standing in prayer and I'm not aware what he said."
But he's a true person who prays doesn't hear anything. He's in another world. Go ahead.
Because he got flew into a rage, kicked him with his foot, and killed him.
Oops.
A heavenly voice issued forth by crying, "Woe to the worthless shepherd that leadeth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right arm." I don't know what the question
is. It is some sort of curse against the Bible. Yes. So
it was intimated to him, "Thou hast paralyzed the arm of Israel and blinded their right arm. Therefore shall thy arm wither and thy right arm break down." Forthwith the sins of the people caused Bethar to be captured, for Hazeba was slain in his head.
That's so bad. Who was slain? Who slain him? Satan, if she doesn't say, we'll get into that. But presumably, the woman. Then it does mention later on that Rabbi Yochanan said that graphic opinion, the children, the remains of the children were smashed on one stone, and 300, but I want to focus on something else. 300 baskets of capsules of phylacteries were found in Beitar. Each capsule having a capacity. So there were baskets of capsules, so there were lots and lots of children.
So far,
what are some of the strikes against Bar Kokhba according to this Midrash? I don't say that the best
source for the Jewish sin. What if someone strikes against him?
Number one. We'll get to that in a second. What are the strikes against him?
Pray that God should be neutral.
He didn't want God to be involved. Next, although they attribute that to his soldiers. But go ahead. What else? Kill the rabbi. Mutilated his students.
Good. Now, then, but on the positive side, he seems that he's very close with this rabbi. We know that Rabbi Akiva was friends with him. Here's Rabbi Elazar Mudai. Is there confusion? Is it really Rabbi Akiva? I don't know. But he's supposedly close with this rabbi, at least until then. And then there are all these tefillin. So in other words, while he may have been a brute whose sole goal in life was to, you know, win wars, the people in Beitar were religious. They were tefillin. So let's return to this. Take a look at this. Share these that I only have. We have an actual letter in the Dead Sea Scrolls, an actual letter that Bar Kokhba wrote to two other officers. And who'd like to read that for us? Any more copies there? I'm sorry.
That's what you were saying?
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Asking that one Yehuda, son of Manasseh, located to still identify Kirat Arbae in the Judean desert, send transfer to two other officers located in Gedi.
So here's the letter. Go ahead.
Similar to you, the son of Manasseh at Kirat Arba, I sent you two donkeys, in order that you send with them two men to Yehonathan, son of Bayan, and to Manasseh in Gaida, so they pack and send to the camp to you.
Okay. We have
a specific letter that he made sure that they had Ravin Nesrodi. It's known as Bar Kokhba. There's a letter we have of Bar Kokhba ordering Ravin Nesrodi for these folks.
So in any event,
So he writes here that love is not just a symbol placed on the coin of Bar Kokhba, maybe the palm is also a Roman sign of victory. Let's read that from Francis Berger. So it's interesting. A lulav is also a weapon. Interesting, you know, whether he had a particular interest in this mitzvah, but we have someone who is reigning in this area. We have someone who is friendly with Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Elazar Mordechai. We have someone who's got lots of kids running around with tefillin. We have the order for Rabbi Nesrogim. And then what do we have there? What does Rabbi Gamliel say? What about the educational system? Who would like to read that? Ruth, want to read that for us? Rabbi Gamliel. In the bottom of page 3. And let's say they're exaggerating. All right, so they had 10 schools. Okay, but they had schools. So they said, the enemy comes, we'll get them with the stylus, you know, with our pen. Anyway, so interesting. There's a memory of his being a brute and a militaristic groom, and there's a memory of his community being filled with rabbis, lulavs, tefillin, etc. So you can get it. You can take a look at some minor changes between this passage and the other. Now, there's a story in Gittin of why Beitar was destroyed, and it's a different story of why Beitar was destroyed, but it's an interesting, it has some parallels to this Talmud Gittin 57a. Some kind of page is not numbered, but you know, computer problems. But anyway, can you find that page? Talmud Gittin 57a. Looks like this. Yes.
How about the fact that Bar Kokhba was a friend of Rabbi Yochanan Bar Kokhba?
Good. So we see from there
that there's something right. There's an opposition. Right. So we have those in the Odai, we have they always say Adai and see from the Odai. We need that guy from Odai because he has all the answers to things. He was a big rabbi. We have Rabbi Akiva on his side, but Rabbi Akiva has critics. Akiva has critics. So we're going to have to analyze that. What was the criticism? What was the problem? Ultimately, we're interested in the question of false Messiah. Why is someone qualified to be a Messiah, not qualified? Why would you say he's good, not so good? Anyway, there's also some other little interesting things here about Beitar. So who would like to read that for us? Rabbi claimed that the shaft of the litter of Beitar was destroyed. Let's take a look. It was a custom. Who would like to read that for us? The page here has 50 Talmud Gittin 57A. It looks like this. Talmud Gittin 57A. Talmud Gittin 57A. Involved, it says Talmud Gittin 57A. Second paragraph. Okay? Who would like to read that? Michael?
Did the shaft of the litter, Beitar was destroyed.
Why was Beitar destroyed? Go ahead.
It was the custom. The boy was born to plant a cedar tree, and the girl was born to plant a palm tree. And when they married, the tree was cut down and the tree could not be planted.
Very charming, very nice, very interesting custom. Go ahead.
And yet, the door of the angel was passed, and the shaft of the litter broke. So the girl dressed some branches of the cedar tree.
Right, her carriage didn't work, so they needed some extra wood. So they cut off some branches of that cedar tree, which was for their wedding. Right. So here you have what echoes does what does this echo? What does this echo? It was a tough place in Beitar. They were tough in Beitar, right? Right? You know, and they're not going to put up with the Romans. They don't care that the Romans, who the Romans are. They mess with it, right? But also, the cedar tree. They chopped off the branches of the cedar tree. See some allusions to that, right? Who's strong? Someone rips out the tree. The Romans can knock down part of the tree. All right, a certain allusion there. Go ahead. Anyway, so then they claim here that that's how it was destroyed. It's interesting, that they're ready to start up with it. Sanhedrin 93b makes a brief has a brief discussion about Bar Kokhba. They call him Bar Koziba, and look what they say, similar to the coin. Michael?
Bar Kokhba went 2.5 years.
Right, just like the coin says, go ahead.
And then says the
Messiah. So here's an assertion that he did say he was Messiah. Go ahead.
What
does that mean? So, in Isaiah 11, which we saw last week, it says, V'harichol b'dvar Hashem. I will give him, in Hebrew, you can take a noun, like ruach, wind, and turn it into a verb. You say, I will harichol him, I will give him spirit. I will spirit him with the word of God. So the rabbis interpreted not spirit, ruach, wind, but reach, smell. That he says, will not judge by his eye. Lo amar nabishpot. He will not judge by his eyes, and he will not judge by his ears, but with the Spirit of God. So they said, if he's the Messiah, he should be able to judge with the Spirit of which they interpreted the smell.
Reach, ruach.
Ruach, wind.
Reach, smell.
They interpreted, he can smell who's right. He can sniff out
the right person. So two people came. He says, say your case.
You're right. So he would.
Interesting. I was studying it in the end of the Talmud. I was studying it three weeks for the Siyam. And the end of the Talmud says that Solomon wanted to get to the 50th gate of wisdom. So he said, I don't want to be able to judge just based on logic. And so the Siyam said, no. We have two, in the Jewish law, you have to have two witnesses. A similar idea, Solomon is a messianic type figure. You can judge without just from the senses. Solomon was, after all, the greatest judge. He was the ultimate judge, the ultimate king, ultimate judge. We want to get back to that. You have to be a judge like Solomon, like Moses. You have to be able to smile and judge. So they want to see if he can do it. Go ahead. We're going to see later that there is a... So all passages of the Talmud claim this, that the Jews slew him, that we actually killed the Messiah. So last week, we claimed that we did not kill that Messiah. Right? This week, we're claiming that we did kill this Messiah. But those words, they slew him. Although they appear in all the manuscripts of the Talmud, in the Yalkut, the Shimoni, one particular later collection of Talmudic stories and things like that about the Torah, in the book of Shmuel, they tell this story, and they leave out that phrase that we slew him. So maybe there's a version that does not say that we killed him. Because that's not the general assumption, that the Jews killed Bar Kokhba. But it does say so there inside. Well, you mentioned before that
you mentioned that this Yochanan this Yoch-
fellow.
Right,
right. So No. Yochanan is the one who told them that he was the grass of gold and the cheese.
Oh, no.
So anyway, so now this passage can be read in one of two ways. You can't, right? Does that mean, what were they expecting from Bar Kokhba? What type of leader were they expecting from him?
Spiritual, right. In general term, spiritual.
But it might go one step further. To be able to judge from your nose, what is that? How would you describe that? What type of thing is that? Yeah. Does that really happen? I mean, do anybody do that? Ah, so it's like what? There's some prophet or what? Probably not really a prophet, right? Or maybe that's a bit of a miracle. Were the rabbis demanding miracles or they're not demanding miracles? This is going to be a question we'll look at later. Okay, moving on to Sanhedrin 17b. When we say that he's referred to sometimes as the Nasi, in some places he's referred to as Nasi. Nasi means prince. In Ezekiel, it does refer to the king as a Nasi, as a prince. But what does he mean to say? Why Nasi? Now, you have to understand that in the Sanhedrin, they had an official Jewish title called Nasi. But even after the temple was destroyed, they didn't have a king anymore, but they had a Nasi. Who was the famous Nasi in? So let's take a look. Was there a Sanhedrin in Beitar where he ruled? So let's take a look.
That was what I was getting at when I asked the rabbis.
Now, the Sanhedrin wasn't killing people anymore, but since the temple was destroyed, there was a Sanhedrin in these different places, roamed around different places. So it says, the Sanhedrin cannot be established in a city which does not contain at least two people who speak 70 languages.
The rabbi's making an assertion again, it could be an exaggeration.
But if you don't speak a lot of languages, you can't be in a Sanhedrin, because people will come to you with a case, and they're speaking in this language, and you don't understand, and you have to listen to the translator. Well, so that's no good. Translators are no good. Yeah, the judges themselves in the Sanhedrin, they have to speak all 70 means all the languages there are. So you have to have two people. And the city of Beitar, there were three. Could imply that in the city of Beitar they could have a Sanhedrin. And if his title was Nasi, maybe he's simply asserting not so much a messianic type of title, but he's asserting that he is the prince of the Sanhedrin. So that's just another twist.
Yes. Yeah,
it was
supposed to be more of a
detective
plus against
the rabbinic interpretation of more of that. This is like, you have to know that my language is that that's how he uncovered the talk, because he spoke that language. Good. Now let's take a look at, this is a very Jewish, classic Jewish discussion. We're not necessarily looking at the
early extant versions of different documents in that time, but we looked at one or two classic Jewish texts, where the way Jews remember the story, and let's see how in medieval times, how did Maimonides particularly, who's sort of the master of what is the Messiah, because he's the only one who wrote a defensive statement about it, kind of, what did he think of Bar Kokhba? How did he see it fit in? We saw last week of what he thought a Messiah was. What does Rambam say about Bar Kokhba? Very strange that he comments on Bar Kokhba. Rambam has a way of not mentioning rabbis by name. And the Tiva is one of the few exceptions. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, maybe. A couple of times he'll mention Rabbi Akiva's name, he liked him. One of his points in his book is not to mention names. This rabbi says this rabbi says that. He doesn't like to say that. He just wants to say, this is the law, period. The idea that he would even mention Bar Kokhba was interesting. Let's take a look.
Let's remember that Rambam was trying to write this grand treatise that describes all of Jewish law in a sweeping view of the past and future. He doesn't need to discuss details like a failed Messiah in the second century. So let's see what, but nonetheless, he does. Who would like to read that for us? Or the other?
For miracles and wonders, bring about new phenomena in the world, resurrect the dead, or perform other similar deeds. This is definitely not true. Proof can be brought from the fact that Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest sages of the Mishnah, was one of the supporters of the king Bar Kokhba, and would describe him as the Messianic king. He and all the sages of his generation considered him to be the Messianic king until he was killed because of sins. Once he was killed, they realized that he was not the Mashiach. The sages did not ask him for any signs or wonders. The main thrust of the matter is this Torah, its statutes, and its laws are everlasting. You may not add to them or distract from them.
So ask me some questions about this passage in the Rambam. What's the problem with this passage? Go through that, especially first of all, he asserts that the Messianic king does not need to work any miracles. And then let's look at his proof. Sorry? What? No, one second. No, the Rambam said you don't have to ask for any miracles. So, right.
Okay.
So this, right. So ask me a question. Ask me some questions. Yes, Jeff.
His proof is just that Rabbi Akiva thought he was the Messiah.
Right.
That was his proof.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to he didn't. It says that he says that you don't have to, that the Messianic king doesn't have to do these things, and the proof is the Rabbi Akiva thought he was the Messiah.
There is a Messiah, even though he didn't do those things. What's lacking? What's lacking? Rambam fails to say why did he think he was the Messiah? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. It basically says that you don't have to presume that the Messianic king has to work the miracle.
Right.
And the proof of that is the Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was the Messiah, and he didn't do those things.
Yeah.
And that's the proof. It's like proving a negative.
Well, one second. What's wrong with that? Anybody want to expound on what Jeff is saying? The Rambam doesn't talk that much about the revival of the dead, but also he views that as separate from the. He says it's amazing the revival of the dead will take place later. That he believes that the revival of the dead is something distinct from the Messianic era. We'll get to that kind of in a minute. But right, so you're right. You could think of certain types of prophecies like the revival of the dead that sound miraculous, but according to the Rambam, you'd have to say that that's not part of the Messianic era. It's part of a different era. It's part of the era of the revival of the dead era. Ask me some more questions about the Rambam. Yes.
Okay. Well, if humans start being born, it is all the sages of this generation did not consider him to be the Messianic
king. No! You just made. Wait! You misspoke. All the sages of his generation, what?
Not all the sages of the generation considered him to be the Messiah.
Who's speaking? Steve Katz or the Rambam?
Yes. The Rambam says all the sages of his generation.
Thank you.
Considered him to be the Messiah.
And your question?
But in actuality, we saw at least one sage.
Right. Very good. So the commentaries on the Rambam are going to point this out, that how could the Rambam assert that everybody agreed that he was Messiah? Where did he get that from? And the contrary, what about the rabbi who thought that grass is going to grow from his cheeks? What are you talking about? All right. What up? What else? Hold one second. Full of ideas. Hold one second. Any other questions on the Rambam based on what we studied? Yes? Oh, right, right. So this Rambam seems to be a very strong thing that seems to say that once he was killed, they realized he was not Mashiach. Now, you can read that one of two ways. Either that this particular fella, when he died, then they said, oh, could he be Mashiach? No, I guess he died. So I guess this guy is not him. Or you could read it, any Messiah who dies, he's not the Mashiach.
Any Messiah, wait a minute.
Any Messiah. Who, right. Well, right. So, there's a famous book, but we'll get into this in the final week, but David Berger wrote a famous or infamous book in which he's very upset about the... David Berger is a Jewish historian, from a medieval historian, and he was very upset that people are not upset that some people within the Chabad movement could assert either that the Rebbe was Mashiach, or the Rebbe could be Mashiach, or the Rebbe might come back, or he could come back as Messiah. Generally, it was assumed, and perhaps you could read that in this line as well, that any Messiah who dies is finished, kaput, not Messiah. He could be very nice, he could be very good, he could be a great, a pious person, he could do great things in his life, but once you're dead, you are not, you're out of the candidacy for Messiah. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, interesting. Okay. Once he was killed. Okay, Steve says this passage itself only says once he was killed, so maybe it's a matter of being killed. Good. Good, interesting. Okay, good. Okay. Now, so we've got a number of problems. Any other problems with this problem? Yes. Questions, comments? Yeah, that's right. We forgot to ask that question. They did ask. What did they ask? They did ask him something. He says they didn't ask him for any signs. Didn't ask him for any signs.
Except for
the guilt, smell of guilt. So they did ask him for signs. Ah, now what could be the answer? Yes? Oh, okay. Good.
Way of saying he was not able to judge people. He didn't know the law.
Very good. Okay, good. You could interpret that. That's not a miracle. They weren't asking for a miracle. They're asking for something of a normal super judge, like a Solomon type figure, should be able to do something like that. What else? Another answer he could give. The rabbi said, "How come you can't judge?" And they got really mad at him. Maybe they even killed him. But he says they never asked him for a sign. Rabbi Akiva thought he was the greatest. What's the answer? Yes.
I don't have an answer to that.
No. Okay. Okay. All right. We'll see an answer to that in a minute. Go ahead.
This does a lot of what you were saying. Maybe it's true that he doesn't have to, that the Messiah doesn't have to do miracles or something like that. But he has to do something. He has to fulfill the basics that we talked about last week, like gathering the Jewish people together and offering the enemy a lot of peace
Right. So. Right. Right. So the Abar Bernel, who was living after the expulsion from Spain, he was very depressed, and he was looking forward to. He was trying to interpret. You know, when is Mashiach coming? He must be coming soon. And he figured out that he's coming real soon. And so he says, why did they think that Bar Kokhba would be it? He didn't seem to have any of the credentials. But we did mention, right, he has an actual state. He fought actual wars. He had some religious credentials. But you're right. This passage is not designed to give any credence to Bar Kokhba, but simply to make the point that a Messiah does not have to perform a threat. So it could be that Rabbi Akiva. One possibility Rabbi Bernal raises is that Rabbi Akiva was simply so full of hope, that he hoped him into it. Yes. Two comments. Yes. You and then Jeff. Yeah.
Well, you saw that Bar Kokhba had seen miraculous victories. I mean, in that story, you see today, like many people, like even in the synagogue, that the state of Israel is the beginning of redemption, and the state of Israel has done nothing. The Messiah would do nothing at all.
Totally wrong. But anyway, it's not our discussion. Okay, one second.
Okay.
There's a lot of similarities between Bar Kokhba and modern Zionism, but there's one problem, Yoah. It's not our topic today. That's our topic on the fourth week. Come on June 11th. June 11th. What is your point, Yoah?
Explanation that sociologically, people see great victory, and they say all these things will come later.
Oh, so the one possibility, another possibility is that Bar Bernal raises. Bar Bernal, a great, not a rabbi, but a great biblical commentator and financier of the year 1500. He says maybe Bar Kokhba is the Messiah, son of Joseph. He's a precursor. But the simple reading is that he did see him as a Messiah, that someone who rebuilds a state of Israel, in mid-Israel, someone who begins to reconquer Jerusalem, that's we're on the path toward the Mashiach, despite what Yoel says. So that could be moving along. Now, that seems to be the simple reading of that the Rebbe Akiva believed that the physical element was very strong. Last week, I didn't get a chance to read it, but a local minister said that there's apparently a Christian joke that goes that something like that, that the Jews were looking for a political savior, and God sent them, according to Christians, God sent them a spiritual savior. So we say, and that's right, and that's why we don't give you no credence at all, and that's why when we had a political savior, we said, that'd be the man. But in the end, turned out to be wrong, and we will get to something similar to what you're saying, but right now we have to try to understand how could he think of him as Messiah. So we'll take a look. The Rambam on the bottom of the page will help us on that. In the meantime, a few details about this Rambam. The Ravad was a contemporary of the Rambam, and he says, wait a second. He asked the question that some of you asked. Didn't Bar Goziva say he was the king, and the sages checked into him if he can smell, and since he couldn't, they slew him. Which the Ravad takes to mean that they did what?
Ask him to
perform miracles. Right. Next, Radvaz is another commentator on the Rambam. And Radvaz, this lives in Egypt around 1500, and he says, there's no doubt that there was a debate among the sages, like Steve's point, about Bar Kokhba. Some did believe he was Mashiach, some did not. Some did, including Rabbi Akiva. And even after the sages sent to see if he could smell, Rabbi Akiva did not change his mind. Now, you see, we had the question before: how could you say that Rabbi Akiva didn't require any miracles? What do you mean the rabbi sent him and said do this miracle, and he couldn't do it, and they left him at that point? So, what would Radvaz's answer be? That wasn't Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva didn't put him to that test. Rabbi Akiva continued to believe in him even after he failed the test. That's an assertion of Radvaz, how he gets it, I don't know. But anyway, you could claim that test has nothing to do with Rabbi Akiva, and that's the Rambam's position, that test has nothing to do with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva never would have put him to that test. He knew he wasn't the most spiritual guy in the world. That's the way it goes. Yes?
So is
that's what they're claiming. But again, maybe that's only their view. Maybe they have a more miraculous view. Maybe that's exactly the debate, which we'll see in a minute. Anyway, maybe no case arose that he needed to smell and judge until he died. And then it became clear. In other words, on the other hand, maybe everybody agreed that he did need to do the smelling test, but it never arose. until later, but if had they arisen, they would have rejected. That which it seems from the Rava that the rabbis killed him, right? It does not seem so. Rather, the Gentiles killed him. Now, how could the Radvaz say that? We saw it in the Talmud. So we saw that there's a midrash on the other side of the page, which I got botched up in the Hebrew fonts got mixed up. But there is a version of the Talmud. It doesn't say that he killed him. Maybe when the rabbis saw he could not judge, they stood away from him and the Gentiles killed him, right? Or it's two different agadot. Maybe there's one story that they did, the rabbis killed him. Another story that the Gentiles killed him. Anyways, there's a question about that as well. Now, Kesef Mishnah is another commentary in the Rambam, and he says the words of the Rambam are true, and so it says in Sanhedrin. But in Eicha Rabbati, in the Medrash we read, it says he was killed by the Gentiles. Our teacher, the Rambam, holds that the Gemara is not following Shmuel, who said that there is no difference in this world and the world to come except for sovereignty. Rambam follows Shmuel. So the Kesef Mishnah, the author of the Code of Jewish Law from the 1500s, he says, wait a second. He says, we've got a debate in the Talmud. It's on the next page. Turn to the next page for a second. Sanhedrin 98b, Brachot 34b. Middle of the next page. Rabbi Chia, second to last page. Rabbi Chia Bar Abba also said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Yoel, read that for us, please. My good friend Rabbi Yoel. Go ahead.
Brachot 34 in the Sanhedrin?
Yes.
Rabbi Chia Ben Abba also said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, all the prophets prophesied only for the days of the Mashiach, but as for the world to come. Wait, I don't remember.
But as...
I have not seen it, O God, besides me.
Okay, listen. So let's just say that a little slower. Thank you. Right? That when anything you see in the prophets of kind of fanciful stuff, that's for the days of Messiah. But there's another thing called the world to come that we never even heard of it. So anything in the prophets, including very miraculous stuff, that's the Mashiach. There's something else called the world to come. That's way beyond. Forget about that. We don't even know what that is. That's like when you die, you know, after life, and maybe when the revival of the dead. That's something else. But a lot of really wild prophecies, it's all for the Messianic era. Go ahead, these rabbis. Right, Shmuel was a rabbi in the Talmud. Go ahead.
Shmuel said, there's no difference between this world and the days of the Mashiach, except that in the later there will be no bondage of sovereign powers, as it says, for the people shall never seek a seed out of
the poor. Right, in other words, just like it says in the Torah, there'll always be poor people. So there'll never be perfection. There'll always be, even in the Messianic era, there'll be some poor people that will give tzedakah. The world will go on. But we'll have sovereignty. Sovereignty. Now, can you see, Rabbi Yoel? You have sovereignty today. You have sovereignty in the days of Bar Kokhba. That's all you need. According to Shmuel's version, that's all you need. Sovereignty. Look, he's got, you see, state of Bar Kokhba. It ain't bad. Right? It's better than the partition plan of 47. But if you get something, right? So maybe says the Radvaz, what you have playing out between the Bar Kokhba and the rabbis who disagree with him, the ones who say, think grass is going to come out of his cheeks, right before the Mashiach comes, is what's Mashiach? There are two schools, and it's mentioned in the Talmud. One school says, sure, you have sovereignty, Mashiach. Other school, you got to fulfill all the prophecies of all the different things, and including the smelling and who knows what else. So maybe that's what it's really all about. We're learning a little behind time. Let me just read this Rambam. The Rambam She'elot Pe'er Hador. It's a collection of Rambam's She'elot and Tshuvot. It's a little bit, I don't know exactly the history of it. It's a little different from his other books. But anyway, listen to what the Rambam writes in this responsa, in this letter. Who would like to read that for us? Miriam, did you have a chance? The Rambam She'elot Pe'er Hador. We're going back. It looks like this. Right, Medina can mean maybe country is not the right word. City state, a Medina, right? A city state's also a state, right? Go ahead. Right. So he seems to be building the case for for Bar Kokhba. Jeff, could you take care of... can you take care of that? Thanks. Thank you. There's a cup over here. Okay. In any event, the he seems to be making a case for Bar Kokhba as Mashiach. Number one, what did he do? He reigned, right? He's a king of sorts, right? It was a settled country. It was very settled, right? And listen to the next assertion. Miriam, thank you very much, Jeff. Good job. Go ahead. Right, so he's claiming that the exiles returned. So this is an assertion. I don't know exactly. You know, I saw someplace else. Talk about that a bit. In any event, it's kind of interesting. So there's an assertion that there's a fulfillment of the exiles returning. That they're claiming that all these Jews are living there. Like you know, in the days of destruction of the temple, you assume it's a very small community. All of a sudden, they're describing, you know, lots and lots of synagogues and children and phylacteries. There's like an ingathering of the exiles or, you know, proliferation of Jews. Go ahead.
The rabbi said in Sanhedrin, the sages of Israel killed him since he said he was Mashiach. It was not the same period.
Okay, now this is interesting. This appears here. I didn't see this so many other places. What? He's not from the seed. I thought he is from the seed. Anyway, from the seed of David. Do you have to be from the seed of David? Or, you know, maybe he's Mashiach. Anyway, go ahead.
And after him, Rufus.
I don't know. He claims that there's two other leaders after him, and they reign for what? So that's another thing. I don't know much about that. But he claims that his sons continue to reign afterwards. But anyway, when the evil Hadrian came and they destroyed Beitar on Tisha B'Av, that was one of the darkest, gloomiest days of ever. And one of the five things, by the way, that Tisha B'Av commemorates is the destruction of Beitar. Destruction of Beitar is one of the greatest calamities. The destruction of the Bar Kokhba Center, which is Beitar, one of the greatest calamities of history, because it's the end. It's the end until later. Even if you didn't think it was a great thing. And that was, not all the rabbis agree with that he was Mashiach. But a lot of people died, that's for sure. They were upset about that. By the way, you can look at this, that the idea that the verse in the book of Numbers, that Bilam, the prophet, or whatever he was, that he said something about the kochav, a star. Classical Jewish commentators like the Unkelus and the Targum Yonasan, classic translations of the Bible from those days, from the Mishnaic eras. Again, we don't have texts predating Rabbi Akiva, but most people, the assumption is that Jews always interpreted that verse to be sort of a messianic verse. And there's a Damascus document, some of the Dead Sea Scrolls from other sects also focus on that verse for their Messiah. So there seems to be a lot focused on that, a lot of hopes focused on that verse. And there, again, dealing with the old question of, like, what kind of messianic guy is this? What did he do? So there's no temple. So, again, if you're just looking to fulfill that verse, it's a little different. That verse is very much about conquering Moab and conquering, what does it say down here? All the sons of Seth. That's people not Jewish. Seth. You know, the other people. Right? Scepter. So it's very much about sovereignty. So it's a good verse for someone looking for just sovereignty. Okay. Now, so if we ask ourselves, well, how did Bar Kokhba fulfill the prophecies of the Torah? So we have this fellow, Richard Marks, the book about Bar Kokhba. He gives five things that he thought were fulfillment. The first one, of course, the Rambam would disagree with. He claims that he was a descendant of David, right? According to the Rambam, not a good one. Right? He freed us from the rogue of the Rome, reestablished a Jewish monarchy, right? This being the core of messianic expectations. Right? You can disagree with Richard, but that's what he claimed. Number three, he fought great nations with the wars, right? It follows the rendition of that verse that we read before. Ibn Daud, elsewhere speaks of a great final war to be waged against Gog and Magog. And apparently Bar Kokhba himself said he had great wars with all the nations. Something like that. Number four, he gathered a very great number of Israelites who returned from their dwelling places. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know where this citation is from, but I don't think it's the Rambam says. There are other sources that claim this idea that he gathered people.
From outside of the
earth. I don't know. That's what the Rambam implies, but yeah. This is some sort of quote, I'm not sure. And then he claims that even Daoud claims, that one of the medieval rabbis, claims there was a violent earthquake as well. You know, sort of a little, you know, some heejee-beejees kind of, you know, something with a little, something, you know, to add a little mystical element to it as well. But I'd like to also claim that there were some religious elements in it as well. And there was that Rabbi Akiva was comfortable enough with them, religiously speaking. That he did have the tefillin and you have the lulav and esrog and there was some hopes in Jerusalem. So I want to claim that there was a hope that Rabbi Akiva had that somehow this was not totally detached from the world of Torah either. Yeah.
I mean, the fact they were allowed to fill in phylacteries,
does that mean that Bar Kokhba was responsible for them, or does it mean that Bajor was even more religious than Jews? Yeah. You could argue, okay, so I'm trying to argue that showed how religious everyone was. You could argue that the idea of Jews shaking a lulav or putting on tefillin, that's like saying that Jews breathed in the morning. I mean, you know, they were Jews, so they did these things. It doesn't show that they were a religious country. I mean, they were just, there was no such thing as secular Jews at that point. Of course they did that. So, but you could also argue that, you know, that surely he wasn't at the early stage before he supposedly killed that rabbi. He was not, you know, anti-rabbinic or anything like that. Now, Rabbi Yosef Grunblatt Lashalom, who was a nice, wonderful rabbi in Queens, had a chance to know. He has a little book called Exile and Redemption, and he writes something that's very, very sweet. And that is, this time of year, we say that we're commemorating the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. So, well, what was wrong with Rabbi Akiva's students? Oh, they didn't give honor to each other. 24,000 students died. 24,000 students? They weren't nice to each other? I mean, what kind of story is that? So some people like to try to associate that with, well, why did Rabbi Akiva die? Well, Hadrianic persecution. He supported Bar Kokhba. Why would his students die? Well, if one of the things he preached was to follow Bar Kokhba, you sure would have a lot of students who would die, you know, because Bar Kokhba gets smashed. So he claims the following. Who would like to read that for us? Barbara, you want to? Yeah, but Rabbi Akiva.
Rabbi Akiva.
Failed.
Failed in Bar Kokhba.
Kokhba.
Killed because of Bar Ashba's sins, the Torah of Rabbi Akiva, and the charismatic missionaries of the
Bar Kokhba.
Kokhba?
Yeah, they usually say Kokhba.
Kokhba. Remained apart. What was the cause of the failure? Why indeed were Rabbi Akiva and his many disciples unable to reach the Bar Kokhba and his followers?
In the sphere. Go ahead.
In the sphere, the period between Pesach and Shavuos, we have another period of mourning, similar mourning. That is, part of his later custom, it is related to the Talmudic story that the disciples of the rabbi Akiva perished during that period, according to the Talmud, he would have also died. As a result of the epidemic of a diphtheria-like disease, but the rabbis never left it at that without seeking a spiritual cause. Why this gruesome punishment? Because they did not act respectfully towards each other.
Good. Oh, the Maharsha, one of the rabbis.
They did not respect each other's Torah. The Talmudim of Rabbi Akiva could not influence and reach the Bar Kokhba because they failed in their relationships to each other.
Right. So he's claiming that when we say that his students died, and this is a little bit fanciful, it's not necessarily so historical, but it's interesting possibility that this tradition, this Talmudic memory that a lot of his students died during this time of year, during the counting the Omer period, and he said, and Rabbi Akiva supported Bar Kokhba. So maybe what he's saying is that he was unable to reach the Bar Kokhba people. He was hoping that the Bar Kokhba people would do the military part, and these would be his students, and he would reach them, and there would be a wedding of the physical and the sovereignty thing, which again Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva made a big deal about that. Oh, sovereignty! Oh, Bilam's prophecy of smashing some of the other nations. That's messianic stuff, but you have to wed that with some of the stuff we talked about last week. I mean, you're supposed to be a great scholar, and you're supposed to bring all the Jews back to the Torah and all that. So all right, so he buys some mulavs, but you know, all right, so he's a good good rabbi. He buys religious supplies for his people, but he was hoping to bring him into the sphere of his learning and to be more Rabbi Akiva like, and that's the failure, is that we have Rabbi Akiva supporting him. We have Bar Kokhba, the great warrior and brute. And Rabbi Akiva was hoping that he would have more influence. Rabbi Elazar of Modai had kind of given up. He was just throwing his hands up to heaven. But Rabbi Akiva was very optimistic. He saw hope that you could wed these two movements, the movement of Torah, which Rabbi Akiva led with thousands of students, and the movement of militarism and these guys who, you know, they see a Roman coming by, they beat him up, and these kind of guys, they can wed these two together. And the tragedy was that the two never met. Basically, he was just wishfully hoping that Bar Kokhba was more than a brute, and he turned out to be nothing of the sort. Yes?
Okay, once already said about Jonas, that Bar Kokhba was the second worst Jew ever.
Why are Yoel and I getting so hot-headed about this, and why did the rabbi say that? Because the Bar Kokhba story very much raises a lot of modern issues, right? Obviously, when why is Masada was for years, they've stopped doing this, but for many years the main place to have army induction ceremonies was Masada, which was which was around this period, because it really excited the imagination of the modern Zionists, the idea of fighting the Romans and having a little state and being fighting to the death, and the rabbis looked at Bar Kokhba and said, look at all these people who died, and you could be very negative about it, and I don't feel that so much, do you? In the Rambam, you don't feel like, and by the way, that wicked guy, could someone grab me from the top, someone who knows Rambam, the top shelf there, and right in the middle over my diploma there, there's a big Rambam, and there's one that's, the last one, yeah. Yeah. There's not number hey or Bob. It has a Shoftim in it. It's not even Shoftim. No, further out to the left. Left. Yeah. Anyway, yes, Lisa.
Okay.
Right. So you're saying, how could such a militaristic era be the messianic era? So, one more. The Vav. Oh, okay. Sorry. One second. Yeah. So you're asking, how could such a militaristic era be a peaceful era? Right. In other words, first you fight the wars of God, and then...
No, that's the goal.
Right. The goal would be a peaceful era. Right. Although, he could claim that, no, an era such as this, let's say, where we're fighting all these wars... I actually wanted bet. Zmanim bet. Thank you. I'm sorry. Give him a hard time. So, see, if you'd agree with me, then I wouldn't give him the bet. Anyway, let's see. Okay. Anyway, yes, Lisa. I'm sorry. Thank you. Anyway, so I'm sorry, Lisa, what were you
saying? Is that the goal?
Right. So if you said, no. You see, Steve mentioned peace. Peace, you would, Shmuel would say, Shmuel the rabbi in the Talmud would say, that peace, that's part of, that. No, all that's for the world to come. What we're hoping for is Messiah. The only thing Messiah is Shibud Malchiot, is getting rid of the evil kings who rule the Jews. When you have your own sovereignty, you're good. So let's say an era like today where Israel is surrounded by weird enemies that are imploding on themselves and sometimes a hostile to a shooting rocket. No problem with that. If sovereignty, it's a messianic era. We'll see. Peace, that's for the world to come. So you could argue that. What I wanted to see was how the Rambam describes the laws of fasting. He says that the Rambam in general is very into the idea of sovereignty. He says Hanukkah celebrates 200 years of sovereignty for Jews. Sovereignty? Those are some of the most wicked, miserable Chasmonaim. I mean, the original Maccabees were very nice, but their children and grandchildren, they weren't really Jewish, and they were evil, and they killed rabbis. It's terrible, right? But the Rambam says, oh, sovereignty for 200 years, terrific. The Rambam says Gedalia, the Tzom, the fast of Gedalia, I mentioned at Baron Hirsch. The Tzom Gedalia is what? Oh, that was our last hope. What was our last hope? It'd be a Jewish governor. Oh, that's, you know, a Jewish governor. He was killed. Oh, it's terrible. The last coal was put out, and it led to our exile. And then he says, and what happened on Tisha B'Av? One of the things, five things that happened on Tisha B'Av, of course, the temple was destroyed twice. And then Beitar was, Beitar was a big city, and there were thousands and tens of thousands of Jews there, and they had a big king, Melech. So he calls Bar Kokhba Melech. And the Dimu Kol Yisrael, all the Jews thought. Dimu could be interpreted as they falsely thought. They were duped into that. But the Dimu Kol Yisrael, he is, again, the Rambam believes that everybody was into this. The detractors were some weird rabbi named Yochanan ben Turtuma, whatever. And Gedolei Chachamim. It doesn't say all of them, but he says, Gedolei Chachamim, great rabbis. Doesn't say all of them. Does say so all of Israel and great rabbis, doesn't say all of them, that he is the Melech Mashiach. And he fell in the hands of the Romans. He fell. So the tragedy is not that Beitar was destroyed, but that the Mashiach fell. And they all died. It was a big tzara. Just like the destruction of the temple. So he's very into Bar Kokhba. He's very, and again, the Rambam is not a historian. This is not a history book. One of the things that gets a little play is Rabbi Akiva, Bar Kokhba, because this idea of sovereignty, he's into that. One of his books is the Book of Kings. That's what we're reading, the Laws of Kings. He's interested in the idea of that Jews can have sovereignty. So this is a possibility. So so if we ask ourselves, how could they have thought that he was Mashiach? We have the possibility that it's just this big delusion. Yoel alluded to it. You know, Jews are always hoping. We're very hopeful people. Rabbi Akiva was extremely hopeful, optimistic type, and he always saw the glass half full. Many stories like that. And so here was this guy. He was miserable from so many different points of view. And like Rav Kook, lived 100 years ago, who said, "Wow, modern Zionism, it's great." Yeah, but they're not doing any of the mitzvahs or anything. Oh, but look, they're building Israel. It's wonderful. It's right. And you know, it's sort of very dreamy kind of a thing. Could be an error. Could be a wishful thinking, could be Mashiach ben Yosef. I mean, the first step, it's not the Mashiach itself, that would be the first step. Could be a extreme version of Shmuel, the Talmud, that sovereignty, that's all you need. Sovereignty is Mashiach. You see, the confusion of terms. You came to a class about Mashiach, you weren't interested in some brute leading the Jews to victory. Yeah. You didn't think of that as Mashiach, you thought of that as, some kind of butcher, right? So that's what the UN would say, right? But one version of Mashiach is a leader, any kind of leader, a leader who would lead Jews, so they have a place where they can live. That's the Mashiach, not the Mashiach the Christians are hoping for, not the Mashiach most religious people are looking for, not the Mashiach we tend to speak of in our parlance, but the Mashiach of Shmuel. Shmuel said Mashiach is sovereignty. That's it.
But
no difference in this world and that world, except for a sovereignty, there'll still be poverty. Problems, there'll still be problems. The religious and the secular and this, that, right? So But this is completely different. Now, in terms of last week's ideas of all the different dreams that we had and things like that, that clearly the Rambam did say that last week we read from the final book, the other book, that we did say last week, the Rambam does say that in order to truly be Mashiach, you need to build a temple and follow all the laws and bring the Jews back to the laws. So, I don't know. I don't know how to make sense between those two ideas. That the idea that somehow the only thing that's important is sovereignty, and then a statement that, no, to be fully the Mashiach, you need to follow all the laws. Unless you're talking about the two different Mashiachs, you lay the groundwork with one Mashiach, then you have the next Mashiach. So, in any event, the Barbanel was very, very perplexed by this whole idea. The Rambam, again, in his system, and with the Radvaz, saying there is a minimalist a Jewish Mashiach idea. Perhaps Rabbi Akiva was from that school. We had then last week a person who says, I'm the spiritual Messiah of every human being, and Jews saying, where's the material part? This week we have someone bringing some material salvation, very briefly, only 2.5 years. But people said, oh, that could be Mashiach. And that was more appealing. Interesting. That was a more appealing Mashiach kind of idea than the more spiritual one. But ultimately, could be that without the spiritual part, without Rabbi Akiva really having a true influence, Rabbi Elazar Modai, again, having real respect for Rabbi Elazar Modai, not just a lip service or an alliance, without that, it did fail. It did need to have a more spiritual component. Ultimately, it didn't, and ultimately, it failed. Yes.
But I mean, according to that, there could be more than one Messiah. Like you could say that Jim and not the Vision Elf, but there's some Messiah since he brought sovereignty. So,
You mean there could be perpetual, one guy's a Messiah and the next guy's a Messiah? Right. I mean, when the rabbis say that Hezekiah was supposed to be the Messiah in the first temple, do they mean the ultimate Messiah? Do they just mean him for that time? It's an interesting question of whether someone could be Messiah, but not the ultimate Messiah. Yeah. You have to usher in an era of eternal sovereignty, or if you have sovereignty for a while. Yeah, the Isaiah refers to Koresh, Cyrus, who let the Jews come back to Israel. He's Mashiachi, but I don't think we usually say that he's the classic Mashiach. But he's anointed to bring the Jews back to Israel. The Second Temple period is a very interesting period because there is no sovereignty. There's just a temple. So that's the other side of it. Could you have a temple without sovereignty? You could take the opposite view. Forget the sovereignty. Just temple. Just religion. No sovereignty. Would that be Mashiach?
Anyway.
Sorry? Well, that's the question. He refers to himself as Nasi. Maybe you can get away without being Nasi. Sorry?
Because
Shmuel says in the Gemara,
the
Yemesh Hamashiach is just sovereignty. Well, one second. Right. Well, the question of whether the Mashiach is a king or whether he is something else, again, Ezekiel refers to him as a Nasi. Okay. Right. Okay. So, right. Rambam, we mourn for the loss of Gedaliah. He wasn't a king.
I'm not saying he's a king. I'm saying in general, they put one
of the king. Right. This is the classic type of problem. If something in the Torah has sort of dubious origins, like, for instance, sacrifice. If sacrifices come from, a concession to paganism, so then would you want sacrifice in the world to come in the Messianic era? So similarly, since we know from the Book of Samuel that kingship has dubious origins, it's something people wanted, so why would you want to have a king in the end of days? So maybe that's why Ezekiel says, we're looking forward for a Nasi. Maybe that's why he calls himself a Nasi. But, so that's an interesting thing. Yeah, it's not clear that he had all the accoutrements of kingship. Anyway, a couple more questions, then we got to go. Yes?
I was told when I was a kid, and later, that the Mashiach was
Right, that's the other version. That's the other version, right? That's the other version, not Shmuel's version, the other version. That all prophecies have to come true. Yes, last question.
But I kind of have a little thing back to history. I think I have a little respect for because the Romans destroyed the temple, and the Jews who was looking for anything, and I think that maybe his heart was in the right place. Maybe, I mean, if I was a man...
You'd be mad as heck that he destroyed the temple.
I would follow him just think, well, you might not be the Messiah, but we're going to form a state. I'd be there fighting.
Right. Well, that's what's interesting. Right. Rabbi Akiva could have just said, oh, Jews living under a certain thing? That's a good thing. Not Mashiach, but it's a nice thing. Yeah, it's good. But instead, he went the other way, that he actually supported him in a different kind of way. But
does he get any pluses with his minuses?
Yes, I'm saying I hear in the Rambam some the idea that he was a melech and a respect for the fact that he reigned for a couple of years in a territory. I hear some respect.
Well, and you talk about, you know, in fact, the Rambam really never talked about people or politics except for really Rabbi Akiva.
Sort of, yeah.
And kind of melded that into this messianic idea. Do you think that maybe the Rambam was trying to show us that it doesn't have to be this or that, but these things together, and so that's we should be looking for.
I said there seems to be a little contradiction around it. To make a big deal about Bar Kokhba and then say the Mashiach has to do all these other things, which we haven't really shown that he did those things, build the temple. Again, the Rambam elsewhere says that he did gather some of the exiles, so he's got some credentials, according to the Rambam, but there's a little bit of mystery how this guy Bar Kokhba could, you know, is he some kind of scholar? I mean, is there any evidence that he was any kind of scholar? It doesn't seem that way at all. So there's a little contradiction there between the acceptance of it.
What I see is almost like a you know, I'm telling you all these things that will help you to
right.
live a more pure life. And by the way, here's something that looked like and could have been, so look out for this coming down the road.
I'm just saying, in the next paragraph, he says you got to build a temple. Yeah, so, but... You know, maybe there are different stages. Anyway, I know it's kind of late, so we'll have to take a break. But next week, if you thought this is interesting, next week is way more interesting. It gets really crazy. And that's Shabtai Tzvi, a 17th century strange person, and who is Mashiach. And then we'll move on to modern era, and we'll duke it out about modern issues in terms of... some modern references to Messiah in our own times. All right. Thanks to all everyone for joining us. Appreciate it.
Right, but just everybody. Yes,
I just the first couple of minutes, bro.
I also have to see that movie.
Could you email me a link?
I'll send you a link. Okay,
yeah, great.
I'll make a note.
Sure.
Like, yo, this is one of the ones you got to pay back.
Yes. Oh, I just want a link to the first one.
Yeah,
I'll
send you
every email.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
It isn't
supposed to be
meant so it jumps in the middle.
No, that's okay.
I'm already saying
a sheet.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any extra?
Because
that's
not
a
little bit.
Huh?
Yeah.
No, I think the state of Israel is rebelling against God. Straight up.
Really,
my point was, even though I don't care. I get that from the video,
but he's not even looking. I mean,
I'm not sure what it is, but
What did you say?
I'm sorry. You can retain the confidence.